Morning, everybody. We're going to get started. First, again, you've probably already seen the signs, and this importance to the residents know also. The internal medicine update conference is going to be the weekend of March 24th, and for all the residents from FAU, the attendings, and also with the attendings from Boca Hospital, it's free registration, so I encourage you to all attend. And register early, because it's filling up pretty quickly this year, actually. This morning, it's my pleasure to announce Dr. Richard Shee, who's going to give us a talk on issues in emergency medicine and toxicology. Dr. Shee completed a 5-year accelerated medical pre-medical program at Pennsylvania State University Thomas Jefferson Medical School in 1988. He did a surgical internship at the University of Maryland and emergency medicine residency at the Medical College of Delaware and a medical toxicology fellowship at the New York Poison Center, Bellevue, New York University Medical Center. He currently is down here helping set up the emergency medicine residency program, and he's going to talk today on obviously a very important topic, toxicology, that we're all seeing all these problems in the ERs now. It's my pleasure.
Thank you very much. Good morning. So it's a pleasure to be here. And also want to say good morning to wherever the other sites are. I can see people on the video. I came from New Jersey. I ran a residency program for 20 years before coming down here in New Jersey at Morristown Medical Center. And I have a picture of my old medical center, so Morristown Medical Center. It's kind of interesting. I know this past weekend, and I'm a pretty passionate football fan. This past weekend was our first weekend without any football for a while, so I'm kind of going into withdrawal. So maybe I'll talk a little bit about that later. It's kind of interesting. So I grew up in Delaware, the Philadelphia area, and I used to follow the Philadelphia Eagles. And then when I moved up to New Jersey, I wanted to take my son to football games. So when he was 7, I bought season tickets, and I chose the New York Jets because they weren't the Giants. That was one of our old rivals, the Philadelphia Eagles. And it's interesting, I've taken my son to many, many football games, many tailgates. And about 10 years into that, my hospital became the official healthcare center for the New York Jets. I mean, I guess if you pay enough money, like $10 million, you can become that. And it's kind of interesting. I would go to football games, and when they were playing, and my hospital would be prominently. Oh, this is actually my son when we first started going, and he's now a college senior at Penn State. And we go to these football games, and the hospital's name was prominently displayed. And then it's kind of interesting, when you pay enough money, every game you can run a medical quiz too, which is kind of interesting. So if you go to a lot of football games, you get to know the other people around you, because many of them have season tickets as well. And many of them are pretty intoxicated as well. But my son, who grew up very proud of his physician father, whenever these quizzes would come up, he'd always volunteer me to answer these quizzes. so this one, what is the human body's largest organ? This one, actually, I knew the answer to, right? Yeah. So typically, the questions were like, you know, how many bones are in the ear? And they'd list 4 things, and invariably, I'd guess the wrong thing. So that's my son's experience with me as a physician, thinking that I was just a pretty bad physician. And then coming down here to South Florida, the Dolphins are, again, an arch rival of the New York Jets. And so from a New York Jets perspective, to be honest, I've met so many people that have migrated to Florida. I rarely meet anybody that's a Miami Dolphins fan. So are there any Dolphin fans here? Oh, so there's a couple. Yeah. So from a Jets perspective, this is what we think of the Miami Dolphins. So So, and as was mentioned before, I came here about a year and a half ago, and I know that a number of residencies have begun over the past couple of years. I see a bunch of the residents, the surgical program directors here as well. I've been in the process of helping to develop an emergency medicine residency. And so I just wanted to take a second just to mention our residency. It's part of the FAU family. That's our main sponsor. It's a 3-year emergency medicine program. Our main clinical sites are going to be at Bethesda and Delray. We have 6 residents per year for a total of 18. We have a number of faculty and then 6 EM core faculty and our program coordinator. I brought a picture of our new core faculty. Many of them have experience training emergency medicine residents. Many of them have migrated and moved their families here to help with the residency. So the other thing is, this is the didactic portion of this lecture. I brought a bunch of cases. I was asked specifically to talk about something that many of you have been dealing with, is really the drug abuse stuff that has, I know people, I work clinically, I see multiple cases a shift now. But I focus the cases that I brought, and many of my I'm presenting to you as unknown, so if people have, you know, comments or questions, please just shout them out. But there's material here for several hours. I can tell you the couple cases that really focus on the synthetic stuff, the cannabinoids and the bath salts, and then also the cases that focus on the opiate epidemic. And then there's one particular case that I wanted to bring just because it is somewhat timely, and it's just an unusual case that I think might be an educational one. This is the 40-year-old woman with bradycardia. So I'll leave it up to the audience. I'll tell you the two. The 19-year-old passes out with K2 package, really talks more about the bath salts and K2 stuff. The heroin OD with big pupils focuses on opiates. So I'd be glad to start with any case. So does anybody want to choose a case? What's that? You want to start with the K2? Okay. So K2 for 400. Let me see if I can get a mouse here. So 19-year-old. Okay, here we are. All right. So case one is a 19-year-old male found unresponsive. And this is a case that I saw the patient in consult. So I didn't see the patient in the ED. So one of my colleagues saw this patient in the emergency department. Was found unresponsive by police, slumped at the wheel of his parked car. Had dilated pupils, was vomiting, and has respiratory distress. And the paramedics at the scene intubated this patient. All right, so, and they found several empty packages of K2. So I'll come back to this case. I want to talk a little bit about K2, spice, and bath salts. And so this is a USA Today article saying, ER docs don't recognize signs of fake marijuana. So we'll come back to this. K2, what is K2? What's spice? So a couple years back, it kind of made news when Demi Moore had a seizure and had been purportedly ingesting spice. And so actually the 9/11 call was released to the public, and it's about 15 seconds, so I thought I'd share that with you.
Hold on, ma'am. Hold on. Okay, tell me exactly what happened there.
Okay, she smoked something. It's not marijuana, but it's similar to incense, and she seems to be having convulsions of some sort.
Okay, are you with the person at this time?
I'm actually in the other room.
Okay, you got a name.
So, it goes on for, if you want to download it or listen to it, it goes on for about 5 or 10 minutes. The middle portion. She lives out in the middle of nowhere, and it's between several EMS authorities, and they kind of fight over who's going to go and transport her. So it's kind of interesting. It's an interesting recording. So I want to talk a little bit about designer drugs because many people refer to the K2 spice and bath salts as designer drugs. And so, first of all, designer drugs has kind of several meanings to different people, different connotations. And so I was a big fan of Breaking Bad. I don't know if people watch Breaking Bad. So some people think that a designer drug is if you have a little bit or, you know, you have enough chemistry background and you can gather certain chemicals and in your basement produce drugs of abuse. Some people view that as kind of a designer drug. And then there's another kind of definition that people use. And the way drugs are made illegal is through our scheduling system, Schedule 1, 2, 3, 4. And the scheduling system is very specific for an individual compound. And they generally do not schedule whole groups or classes of drugs. And so as this Gary Trudeau cartoon kind of points out, so one way you can skirt the laws is if you take a specific drug that has some sort of drug of abuse potential, and you can add a molecule, take off a molecule, and create a new compound. Hopefully it retains most of its pharmacologic properties and its euphoric effects, and then it's not illegal. And so as an example, and this was a 1980s outbreak, the China White outbreak, fentanyl was converted to alpha methylfentanyl and 3-methylfentanyl. They believe the source were veterinary fentanyl at that particular time. And that led to a huge outbreak. And so these drugs are actually more potent than fentanyl and led to a large outbreak. And if we do the opiate cases, I can go over those outbreaks as well. But it led to designer drug law in the mid-80s. And the wording of the law was to prevent designer drugs. And it did not want to stop innovation. It did not want pharmaceutical companies from making new compounds and so forth. And so the wording was that it was not intended for human consumption. And so it's kind of interesting. It took the drug dealers a couple decades to figure this out. And this is what's behind the K2 spice, the synthetic cannabinoids, and the beta-ketone amphetamines. Those are the bath salts, and I'll show you some of their structures shortly. So that's really the key, unless intended for human consumption. So spice and bath salts, this is really just a marketing tool. Obviously, the cannabinoids and the amphetamines, they're not bath salts. They're not herbal incense, but they're marketed that way. And on the packages, they all have not for human consumption. So they're actually packaged in very nicely looking, very official looking packages. So this is a package for spice. And on the back of all of these things, you'll see this not for human consumption. What it has done is allowed these drug dealers to kind of skirt the laws, and many of these products were marketed on the internet. They're still marketed on the internet, sold in convenience stores, 7-Elevens, and so forth. And so just to give you an idea, and this is a paper looking at the contents of some of these products. And this is a study that was done out of Penn State in 2011. So just to give you an idea, here's the materials and methods. I've highlighted what I want to point out to you, and I've just blown it up. So 14 samples were purchased at a local head shop in State College, PA in 2011. My son is a senior at State College right now. And here are some of the names of all of these. Recharge, White Rush, White Girls, Bath Salt, etc. And so here's some pictures of these products they bought at these head shops. And then they analyzed them. And these are all different types of amphetamines. They're in the group known as cathinones, and I'm going to talk more about it. So I'm just pointing out how easy these things have become to obtain and how they were skirting the laws and how they still skirt some of the laws. And I'll talk about that shortly. And so there's a lot of advantages to being able to sell your product in a regular store over the internet. So the buyers perceive this stuff as legal. They perceive it as safer. It's much easier to obtain. You don't have to go to some street corner and give cash to some drug dealer. And since these were new compounds, the vast majority of them had negative tox screens. So even though they were cannabinoid-like, the TH screens were negative. Even though they were amphetamine-like, the amphetamine screens were negative, generally speaking. And so Spice takes its known from a science fiction book series, Dune. The wide-open-eye imprint is found on a lot of these products, and there's a fictional drug, Melange, which is referred to as Spice. So that's just one of its names. But on the internet, there's so many different marketed names. But Spice and K2 are just the most common for the synthetic cannabinoids. And so what they would do, these manufacturers, they would purchase some known cannabinoid. They'd purchase it from a chemical or drug supplier and usually come in a powdered form. They would dissolve it in a solvent and then spray it on a smokable plant and then package it very, very nicely. And so that was generally how it was sold. When users are surveyed, they generally feel like the whole experience is like smoking marijuana. The euphoric effects are like smoking marijuana as well. And just to give you an example, there's three main types of synthetic cannabinoids. The HU series, which was developed out of Hebrew University, the CP series, which was out of Pfizer, and then there's an organic chemist out of Clemson, J.W. Hoffman. There's a whole series named after him, the JWH series. So just to give you an idea of the resemblance. So here's THC, and you can see how these other ones resemble that. All of these synthetic cannabinoids have effects at cannabinoid receptors. And so the development of other synthetic cannabinoids is, from a pharmaceutical perspective, is easy to understand. You know, if you can develop some drug that increases appetite, there's definitely a market for that. It's something that might be able to treat seizures, something that would be good for pain relief, etc. If you could take away the euphoric effects, it could be a blockbuster pharmaceutical agent. So there are a number of labs, number of pharmaceutical companies that are trying to develop these and market these. And they're listed. A lot of these things are published and fairly easy to obtain. And so when you survey users of these synthetic cannabinoids, as I mentioned before, the feeling is that you are smoking marijuana. But it's interesting, in my 20 years in the emergency department, I've probably taken care of between 5 and 10 marijuana users. And generally speaking, they don't end up coming to the emergency department. The typical patient we see is some boyfriend who makes like marijuana brownies and slips them to his girlfriend. And I guess she just doesn't expect to have kind of weird sensations and so forth. And that type of person has some sort of kind of psychotic reaction and will come to the emergency department. So in general, we just don't see medical problems related to marijuana. I can tell you with K2 Spice, we see them very, very frequently. So I'm not going to say that these are the same. We certainly see lots and lots of medical cases come to the emergency department. The big problem with all these designer drugs is that we're not sure what agent we're dealing with. You can send off a sample of their blood to be analyzed, and the labs, some labs are more capable than others, but generally speaking, that information's not useful or available quickly, so clinically it's not particularly useful. So most people handling these cases will not send out drug screens on them. And certainly the urine drug screens available at a typical hospital will not have the capability to differentiate the specific synthetic cannabinoid. So most of the data out in the literature is class-specific. It's not compound-specific. So generally speaking, when someone comes in saying their friend did K2 or Spice, we really don't know what class or what specific agent that they've ingested. And some of the symptoms that have been reported have been anything from like a psychotic experience, which I described before, classical marijuana, to tachycardia, hypertension, to agitation, seizures, and then respiratory depression. Bath salts, and again, they're not real bath salts. They're just marketed as bath salts. And certainly, there are legitimate bath salts. And so people buy bath salts to treat rheumatologic conditions and so forth. But in this particular case, bath salts are, it's just a way to market these types of amphetamines. And bath salts are a specific class of amphetamines, generally speaking. They're the cathinone amphetamines. These are derived from a plant, cot. And so I'll just give you a sense of what it is. This is, so here's amphetamine. So the phenylethylamine, which is part of all the catechols and all the amphetamines, if you put a ketone in the beta position, that is where that's classic for cathinones. They're also known as beta ketone amphetamines. And so here you have methamphetamine and methadrone. And so MDMA over here and methylone by just adding that beta position ketone. They're, interestingly, and here's an example of one bath salt. It's entitled, it's called Ivory. And you can see the not for human consumption down here. They're also marketed as plant food. And so here's just a website with sky plants. So you can see some of these types of cathinones. So supplier of methadrone, number one supplier of methadrone plant feed shop. And it's interesting, since they're sold legally, they really don't have great instructions on how to use them. And we've taken some calls at Poison Center, and people are trying to figure out how to get high off of some of these stuff. So they'll sprinkle the bath salts on into a bath and try to inhale the aroma. And so the on back of one of the products for plant food, I've read the instructions. It says for a 70 kilogram plant, use X milligrams. So it's kind of interesting how they're trying to skirt the skirt the drug laws and also market their product. The other thing about this is that it's fairly inexpensive to use for the drug user, and so typically you'll get half a gram in a package, and these are really milligram dosages. And so there are many people marketing this, and there's many different names, but generally the main classes are bath salts and plant food. Clinically, when you survey users, they most commonly use it like cocaine, so they'll smoke it. In terms of the experience, that's pretty much what they report. And the symptoms are euphoric, hallucinations, and then what we really deal with is the severe agitation and the violence. So I'm going to take you to another case just to highlight that. So a 25-year-old male smoking gravel with friends. So gravel is another name for flaca because of its appearance. So flaca was a major problem here in Southeast Florida, especially in Broward County. So flaca is made from a synthetic version of the stimulant cathinone. So I'll go back to this case. 25-year-old male smoking gravel with friends over the next several hours, had hallucinations and sudden violent behaviors. They called 911, arrives in the emergency department, agitated and violent. And so agitation and violence, and I'm not going to focus too much on this, but I'm going to focus on one particular issue with the bath salts. And certainly, restraining someone, you really need to restrain someone before you can pharmacologically try to restrain them. And so this is a big area of concern with Jayco, and I'm not really going to talk too much about it. And typically, pharmacologically, we'll use either benzodiazepines or an antipsychotic or together. The experience here in South Florida is that if you follow that approach, they're so agitated and violent that you'll end up using mega doses of benzodiazepines to really achieve what you need to achieve, which is just to calm them down. And so it's that combination has not worked particularly well, and that's generally the combination that's used for most agitated individuals from whatever cause, whether it's drug-induced or psychotic-induced, et cetera, or some other medical cause. And so I just wanted to highlight something that's kind of been written about a little bit in the literature, and it's the use of ketamine, especially pre-hospitally, for severe agitation. And there have been a number of papers that have come out recently, especially in the past couple years. None of them are randomized controlled trials, and that's the unfortunate part of it. Most of the studies are done pre-hospitally, and advocate using fairly high doses of ketamine. And so they're talking about doses of about 5 milligrams per kilo. In the studies that are published, the typical doses are between about 100 milligrams to 400 milligrams, and they average about 200 milligrams. And it's rapidly given and subdues these individuals very, very quickly. And when you talk to some of the ED docs in the middle of it in Broward County, they've pretty much moved towards using this just because from their own anecdotal experience, it just works better. The one thing about this is some of the early papers seem to suggest that the intubation rates with this method have been increased a little bit. So that's one of the downsides of using ketamine as an agent to subdue these individuals. The other thing about the severe agitation and the hallucinations is that there's a lot of dangerous behavior associated with these cases. So whether they're firing guns at non-existent people, jumping out of a balcony, fighting with multiple people, lying down in the middle of the highway, those are just some of the reports that are coming with the use specifically of bath salts and flagga. So let me go back to case two. Arrives agitated and violent. 8 people were required to restrain the patient. Ketamine 400 milligrams were administered, and they had good control of the agitation. So alpha pyrrolidino valeroquinone, or APVP, that's the other name for flacca, definitely has been associated with sudden death, with a number of medical problems. Interesting for synthetic amphetamines from 2010, where most of it was ecstasy and MDMA, you're seeing this replaced by different types of bath salts, and really reached its peak in 2015 with flacca. DEA statistics reveals Broward County leads the nation in flacca-related cases. And South Florida source for synthetic drugs, and the main source was really through the internet and through the mail from China. And it's also believed to be the reason why flacca, the whole flacca epidemic has, to a certain extent, gone away. And China was part of limiting sales of flacca through the internet. And drug dealers were simply going on the internet to different pharmaceutical supply companies in China and just ordering these different synthetic products. And they would just ship them through the mail to them or ship it to some other country and it'd be brought into the United States. And so in late 2015, 2016, we saw a big decrease of flacca. And for the most part, flacca has gone away. So the designer drug loophole, and I'm just giving examples of what the government has done, but I think the loophole is still there. That's why we're still dealing with this problem. So in 2011, they temporarily put Schedule 1 banning on 5 different synthetic cannabinoids, several different bath salts. In 2012, a bill was passed, and they put 15 synthetic cannabinoids and another 11 synthetic BKAs on Schedule 1. And the problem is there is another 30 or 40 different synthetic cannabinoids or different amphetamines out there that are available. And again, it's just a loophole. And so I'll just give you an example. I showed you this before. And so after the initial ban, you'll see it on the packaging, excuse me, it says lab certified. This product does not contain all of the different banned synthetic cannabinoids. So this is, the drug dealers are just staying ahead of all the drug laws. And so we still deal with this. This is still available online. They're not as available in convenience stores, but certainly in head shops. I've been in some head shops over the last months to over the last couple of years since I've kind of taken an interest in this. And you, if you ask for it, look for it, that you can still buy these products. And so this is just an example of the different compounds that the DEA has placed in either temporary bans or permanent bans. And this is just an ongoing process. So let me go back to case number one. So this is that 19-year-old male found unresponsive by police, slumped at the wheel, empty packages of K2. And so on ED arrival, the vital signs are fairly unremarkable. The patient is intubated, not following commands, but does withdraw the pain. IV fluid antibiotics were started. The white count was very elevated, and because of that, a meningitis workup was begun. They did an LP. The LP was negative. Was admitted to the ICU and was extubated on day two. And on day two, the patient was awake, alert, had a normal CNS exam. He said he was a chronic marijuana user, and a friend gave him K2 and said this was just easier and better, and that was the first time he ever tried smoking that. I spoke to him 3 months later. He was in full; he had fully recovered, no neurologic sequela. He said this K2 stuff is horrible. I'd be glad to go to high schools and speak on the dangers of it and so forth. So that's the end of that case. So in summary, for these emerging drugs, K2 spice, synthetic cannabinoids, bath salts, these BK amphetamines, there's multiple loopholes in the drug legislation, and this continues, so we're still dealing with this. Clinically, the cannabinoids, we see more medical problems than we typically see with regular marijuana, and the bath salts, we see lots of agitation and violence, and they come to hospitals very, very frequently. I think I've run out of time, so... So it goes to 8:30, excuse me. Yeah, I'm sorry. Okay. So that's that case. I can move. Go ahead. It's really difficult because there's so many different compounds you're dealing with, and they don't know which specific compound you're dealing with. So we kind of, unfortunately, speak in generalities about the class. My particular take on it is I think it's more of a dose issue. Yeah. And then we are finding out that some specific compounds have much, much worse problems associated with it. I think Flacca had more, even though all the bath salts were associated with hallucinations and violence and abnormal behavior. I think Flacca had a little bit more than some of the other compounds. Okay. I think I could probably do one other case. You want me to do the opiate one? I'll do the opiate one. Okay. So So this is a 46-year-old male brought in by a friend and dropped off at the ED front door. My wife is also an emergency physician. This is actually one of her cases. So he was dropped off at the front door. He said to the nurse, the triage nurse, that he overdosed on heroin, and he said he was going to go park his car, and then he basically just drove away. So he pretty much did his duty. We see this a lot. You know, he knows something weird is going on, and they bring him to the hospital. And if you're a drug user, if this happens to you, you're lucky if your friend will do this for you. So initial vital signs, pretty unremarkable. On physical exam, moves to painful stimulation. The pupils were 6 millimeters, so not what we typically see with heroin, meiotic pupils. Otherwise, the exam was unremarkable. So this doesn't really come through very well. But the pupils were large, maybe a slight decrease in respiratory rate. And so with heroin overdose, we typically see a triad of meiotic pupils, respiratory depression, and altered mental status. And so clearly he did not have meiotic pupils. I was with, and I'm just making a point with this particular case, but I was with a medical student in a similar case. The medical student was very excited, wanted to help out, and began, you know, kind of rustling through this patient, that particular patient's clothes, and was about to reach into the person's pocket, and I stopped him. What, you know, a good medical student generally has is one of those trauma shears, and I told him, just, you know, get a pair of scissors and, you know, cut off the clothes. I'm not sure what's in those pockets. And it was interesting, in one of those pockets was a brown paper lunch bag. And we dumped out the brown paper lunch bag, and you can see an insulin syringe, a cotton swab, and a kind of a multi-use insulin needle. Excuse me? No insulin, yeah. anybody know what the cotton is used for? So they generally will filter their drugs through the cotton swab. And so on the street, when they, before they inject it, that's one of the things that they will do. They'll either use a coffee filter or a cotton swab. The cotton swab is associated with some medical problems. So it can cause fever. So cotton fever, when you do an FUO workup for an IVDA, that is a potential cause for the fever. So would you give this person naloxone? So he says his friend says he's using heroin. He comes in, he's altered, has decreased respiratory rate. So in this particular case, the naloxone was given, and what we found was a wildly agitated and hypertensive tachycardic patient. So any thoughts? So withdrawal is certainly a possibility, but he didn't have some of the other stigmata, wasn't vomiting, et cetera. There is a combination speedballing, which is heroin plus an amphetamine or cocaine, an upper with a downer. And so if you take away the heroin, sometimes you can get a response like that. So I'll give you a more physical exam. The skin is warm, dry, and flushed. And so clinically, looked like he had an anticholinergic syndrome. And so it's kind of interesting. We ended up giving this person physostigmine, which is an antidote for this, for anticholinergic syndrome. And over the next 4 or 5 hours, this person kind of slowly woke up and was discharged from the emergency department. It's interesting, and I'll give you the background behind some of these cases. My wife went to work in an emergency department that was on the outskirts of Newark, New Jersey. And over the phone, she called me. She goes, I don't know what the heck's going on, but I think we have a toxicologic ICU here. And at that particular time, she said there was multiple patients that all presented in the same way. And at that time, I was at home watching our young kids, and I told my wife, I said, I'm going to take the kids. I'm coming. And she said to me, if you come, I'm going home with the kids. So I didn't have credentials at this emergency department, so I didn't go. But we worked through this case, and she had a super busy night dealing with over 10 of these patients, where she would give them little doses of naloxone, small doses of naloxone, reveal anticholinergic poisoning behind it, and then give them doses of physostigmine, and then discharge them over 4 or 5 hours later. The next day, I went into the poison center because I was on call that night, and I started going over cases and found out that there were multiple similar cases at many different hospitals throughout that area. And then I took a phone call from one of the hospitals, and the head of the ICU says to me, he says, what the heck is going on? He goes, I've got like 12 patients in my intensive care unit intubated and paralyzed. And I said, you do? It's kind of interesting. And what he said was that that these heroin patients, they gave naloxone, became wildly agitated, and so they paralyzed and intubated them. And so I told him what I thought happened. I said that that's one way to treat those patients. I told them that I thought that he could probably extubate all those patients today. And I had been in discussion with some of the local police, and they were analyzing. We had a pretty good idea what it was at that point. It was a mixture of heroin and scopolamine. And so this was the beginning of what was known as the Polo outbreak. And so the name Polo has nothing to do with scopolamine, or maybe it did have something to do with scopolamine, but different drug dealers brand their product. So they may be selling heroin, but they actually try to develop their own clientele, their own business. And so they'll actually brand their heroin, so to speak. So people know to look for that particular product. And so the particular brand that we initially dealt with in these cases were the Polo brand. And it, some people referred this as the Polo outbreak. We ended up, the local poison centers in that particular area ended up probably taking 400 or 500 calls. But I think as the emergency physicians became familiar with what was going on, we got called less and less. And so this was a wide outbreak. The initial cases were seen in New Jersey, moved into New York, moved down to Baltimore, and then moved to other parts of the country. So that was just an unusual outbreak that kind of began and ended over about a 3 to 6 month period. Another outbreak, which I kind of referred to before, was this China White outbreak. And this happened in the early 80s. I was not in New York City. I wasn't in medical school at that particular time. But when I came to New York City, they used to talk about this outbreak quite a bit. And a typical case was someone who thought they were doing heroin, they were found with the needle still in their arm. The other thing they found out was that these individuals, again, thought they were doing heroin. They would be given naloxone. There was no response. They would come to the emergency department, and their drug screens were negative. So the paramedics, being very, very practical and super smart, said, this, looks like an opiate, smells like an opiate. I don't know why they don't respond to regular doses of naloxone. And back then, naloxone ampules were 0.4 milligrams. They started doubling and tripling the dosages of the naloxone, and lo and behold, they found out that they would get partial responses. So they started giving even higher doses of naloxone, and started giving gram dosages and 2 to 3 gram dosages, and get good responses with them. And what we found out, again, this is that fentanyl outbreak. It wasn't fentanyl. It was actually 3-methylfentanyl, alpha-methylfentanyl. But they didn't know what they were dealing with, so it took the chemist a couple months before they could figure out what the actual compound they were dealing with. And so it's kind of interesting. A couple things were learned from this epidemic is that naloxone does not affect all opiates the same way. And so here's a New England Journal paper that was published in 2012. And so originally, when you had someone that was overdosing on heroin, typically you wanted to give them a dose that would stop them from their overdose. You'd like them, you know, to continue breathing. So usually you'd give it because they had respiratory depression. You did not necessarily want to wake them up, because if you gave them too much naloxone, you might bring on withdrawal, or you might bring on someone who gets very agitated. They were euphoric in the middle of some heroin high, and you've just reversed it. They wake up in a hospital where there could be a policeman around the corner. It's very common for them to either elope, pull their IV out, or just want to sign out against medical advice. And the problem is that heroin has about a 4 to 6 hour duration of action, where naloxone's duration of action is about 30 minutes to an hour. And so there's a real possibility that they can resedate, they can have reoccurrence of respiratory depression, et cetera. When I trained, we were taught to give very small doses of naloxone, 0.1, 0.1, 0.1. For the naturally occurring opiates, that dosage works very well. So morphine, codeine, heroin, that low-dose naloxone works very, very well. What we found out over time, semi-synthetic opiates do not respond as well. And so that's where you start dealing with large doses of naloxone. And so this protocol or this algorithm, so initial adult dose, 0.04 milligrams. If you get no response within a minute or two, go to 0.5, then 2 to 4 to 10 to 15. I've never given 10 milligrams of naloxone. And generally speaking, if you've given 3 to 5 milligrams of naloxone, you should get some partial response. If you get no response, then I don't move to these massive doses of naloxone. So let me go back to case number two. That outbreak, that China white outbreak, started on the East Coast and moved nationally. Up till that point, that was kind of the first massive epidemic of heroin users where the compound was really not heroin. The polio outbreak was the second one that occurred in the Northeast that I'm aware of, that toxicologists were aware of. Let me present another case of a heroin outbreak that occurred in the Northeast. Case number two, 25-year-old male heroin abuser, quote, felt funny after snorting heroin. His typical heroin use was 2 to 3 times per week. He had no other past medical history, presented to an emergency department in New Jersey. His blood pressure was low. He's very tachycardic, tachypneic, who's afebrile, and his pupils were dilated. Okay, so again, this is not your typical opiate overdose. So the labs of note, the potassium was very low, 2.2. The glucose was elevated as well. Had some ischemic changes on his EKG, which were nonspecific. Poor urine output. In the ED, they gave a lot of fluid, 5 liters. So started to urinate at that point. The urine tox screen was positive for opiates and THC. Was agitated and tachypneic. And was treated with diltiazem and haloperidol. I'm not sure if I would have given the diltiazem. When we spoke to the physician, we were consulted on the phone at the poison center. He was just worried about the tachycardia and gave diltiazem. Blood pressure later dropped to 60 over 13. The ABG showed a pH of 7.27, PCO2 29, so metabolic acidosis. The pupils were very dilated, and lactic acid was 10. Mixed venous oxygen, the PVO2 was 72, normal is about 40. So because of that, the elevated lactic acid and the high PVO2, we were wondering if this was some type of toxin that inhibited the use of oxygen, affected the Krebs cycle. And this really did not come through very well. This is just a sample from another patient, and the tubes of blood on each side was from that particular patient. And to the clinician at the bedside, it looked very, very red to them. And so some of these agents that can potentially disrupt cellular metabolism at the Krebs cycle, cyanide really kind of came to the forefront. And so cyanide binds to cytochrome oxidase and causes extreme elevations in lactate, causes cellular hypoxia, even though your PO2 and your PVO2 is actually elevated. And the treatment for that is the use of amyl nitrate pearls, sodium nitrite, and sodium thiosulfate, although there is another treatment that is FDA approved since that time, hydroxycobalamin. And the way the nitrites and the nitrates work is to form methemoglobin. It's an abnormal hemoglobin, and that this methemoglobin will bind to cyanide and form a non-toxic metabolite, cyanomethemoglobin. And so the other reason why the feeling was that potentially this was cyanide-related is that in the literature, cyanide has been associated with heroin usage. And on the streets, it was known as a death hit. So if for some reason you had a conflict with your drug dealer, there have been cases where they spike the heroin with cyanide and the user dies from it. So it's probably not a good business model to follow. But certainly if you have some sort of conflict, it's one way to resolve that conflict. We advise the clinician to administer sodium thiosulfate. This is the third part of the cyanide antidote kit. And after that was administered, the physician at the bedside felt the patient was, you know, looked better, was feeling better. The blood pressure was a little bit better. The pulse came down a little bit. Later, the heart rate seemed to go back up. The patient became more anxious, asked for some Valium. They remeasured the PVO2, and it was still very, very elevated. And so the sodium nitrate was administered. And after that, again, the patient seemed to breathe easier, seemed to feel better. Post-sodium nitrate, the PVO2 was still elevated, and the methemoglobin was 6.6. And so if you have someone that's being treated for cyanide, the methemoglobin would bind the excess cyanide. So the methemoglobin level really should be close to zero. So that was really not consistent with cyanide poisoning at that time. PVO2 later was 181. And then two more patients came into this emergency department with similar symptoms, similar presentation. So that was what we were left with. And we formed a case definition, a heroin user with acidosis, hypotension, hypokalemia, hyperglycemia, and elevated PVO2. And so in this day and age of the internet, the way you would spread medical news before was to publish in the MMWR. They just would publish a little bit faster than other journals. So if you're trying to get something out, for public health reasons. The CDC has a website called EpiX, Epidemic Information Exchange. And so the information was submitted to this website with that case definition, just to let other clinicians know that these cases were, there were multiple cases. And at that particular time, there were six cases that had come through the poison center. And we suspected that there were more cases in other emergency departments. So the initial three patients When cyanide testing was available, they were negative for cyanide. So, and also they were negative for heroin. And it turned out that the agent that was sold as heroin was clenbuterol. So this is a beta agonist. It's not FDA approved in the United States. It's FDA approved in Canada. And so that EpiX info was updated to clenbuterol, not for cyanide. So it's a potent beta agonist. It's popular for bodybuilders. Not clear if it has any euphoric effect. But one great source of drug user information, there's a bunch of these websites, but one of the more popular ones is this one called Arrowid. So if you go to Arrowid, there are descriptions of the use of clenbuterol to get high, okay? And this particular description fits the cases that I just described to you, and the user purports it to being using too high of a dose. So clenbuterol, interestingly, there have been some other medical cases of clenbuterol toxicity. Clenbuterol has been documented in 4-H competitions for cattle, so it's been found as a contaminant or a doping agent. And then cattle, veal that were obtained from clenbuterol or cattle that were given clenbuterol led to an outbreak of greater than 100 people in Spain. So the symptoms they had were tachycardia, nervousness, muscle shaking, muscle pain, headache. Their serum and urine were tested and tested positive for clenbuterol. All these cases were later published in the MMWR. Not as many cases as the scopolamine heroin cases. We feel that there were a number of unidentified cases. And later on in the state, having spoken to a number of physicians, many of these cases were unidentified. They were just admitted with sepsis workups that turned out to be negative. Over the next couple days, these cases generally just resolved on their own with supportive care. From 2006 onward, but in 2006, we started seeing spikes of fentanyl, first in New Jersey, but this mirrored the rest of the country. And at that particular time, the feeling was that this was internet synthetic production in home labs in the United States. So if you go on the internet, you can find recipes for manufacturing fentanyl pretty easily. And what we've seen since then is a continued rise of opiate overdoses. And certainly in South Florida, over the past couple of years, a major epidemic. And I've talked to some of you already, I think there are more people that are opiate abusers, but the ones that are using agents that are much more dangerous. The therapeutic index is much narrower than, let's say, using heroin. And the agents we're dealing with now are these synthetic ones that are coming from overseas. These are fentanyl or fentanyl-like agents. So again, some statistics from Broward County that opiate deaths are on the rise over the last several years. Heroin overdoses in Delray hit record in July. This is the statistics from the DEA. This is fentanyl seizures in Florida. So you can see how they've increased and the amount of fentanyl that the law enforcement agencies are finding is massively increased. My parents were born in China, so my parents are immigrants, I consider myself Chinese. So, again, the blame is felt to be from China. And so there have been a number of news reports really linking these outbreaks to China, whether it's from Flacca or from these synthetic fentanyls. This is one particular article that I read. And they named a bunch of websites. And so over the last couple months, I went onto these websites. So here's one particular website. This is a chemical pharmaceutical supply company in China. So it's, you know, kind of sleek looking. You have two nice looking young people in bikinis or bathing suits. And then if you go down, they talk about their products. And so you can see they have a number of products, but carfentanil or different types of synthetic drugs of abuse. And in fact, the DEA, and this is an article I read recently, the DEA opens a shop in China to help fight some of this synthetic drug trade. And so more recently, and here was a new story, over 50 dead after ingesting new South Florida drug. And so carfentanil has been an agent that has been implicated. And so carfentanil, just to talk a little bit about it, and I've spoken to a pathologist that works in the Broward County area and some of the physicians taking care of these patients. And the belief is that that a lot of the opiates they're dealing with are carfentanil-related. And so what carfentanil is, it's interesting, it's mostly, if you do a literature search on carfentanil, it's mostly in the veterinary literature. Because it's so potent, it's really used for sedating large animals. Like this study, anesthesia of the Tibetan yak. So this is a study using carfentanil and some other agents. So the Tibetan yak, it's just a picture of a Tibetan yak. So carfentanil, another name for this is wild nil. So they're not wild anymore. And so it is felt to be the most potent opiate available that's known at this particular time. So here's just a potency grid of the different types of opiates, morphine being the standard of one, fentanyl 300 times potent, alpha-methylfentanyl, 3-methylfentanyl, which I talked about before, are 10 to 15 times more potent than fentanyl, and then carfentanil we're dealing with probably 30 times more potent than fentanyl or 10,000 times more potent than morphine. So as I mentioned before, yes, we're dealing with more drug users, but I don't think it's a massive amount of drug users. What we're really dealing with is people trying to use drugs that are just more difficult to use safely. The therapeutic index is just very, very narrow. You're not dealing with milligram dosages of morphine. You're dealing with microgram dosages of some fentanyl-type agent. And so I really believe that's the main reason we're seeing so many of these overdoses. I can tell you the pharmacology for carfentanil. There's really very little data in humans. It's all based on animal data. It's very rapid onset, has a fairly long half-life in animals. So again, this is another problem we're dealing with clinically, is if you wake these individuals up from some overdose, the duration of action of carfentanil is potentially prolonged, and they're really, really at risk for resedation or their toxicity to return. All we know is the naloxone dosages are very high, and you may need to use multiple dosages. And the other thing is carfentanil is so potent, it can get aerosolized, and it can pass through skin. And so they are teaching the paramedics that when they're on the scene, that they potentially can get poisoned as well. And just to highlight this risk, carfentanil is felt to be what was used during that Moscow theater hostage situation, where carfentanil was aerosolized. There's other papers that talk about the use of and the potency of carfentanil. And so heroin, what is in the mix? There have been a number of things that have been found in heroin. That cyanide, a death hit, strychnine, fentanyl analogs are really what I believe is a major problem that we're dealing with. Scopolamine, the polo outbreak, clenbuterol, cheese is another name for Tylenol PM being sold as heroin. So that's just a little bit of an update in the saga of how heroin has evolved over time. I can't predict what's going to happen in the future. But it's fascinating what drug users are willing to kind of put inside their bodies. So I think I'll have to end here. I've kind of gone over my time. So if anybody has individual questions, please just come up and I'll address them. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.